te voy a decir que aquí todo el mundo es bueno también.
I'm not telling you that everybody here is good because that would be lying to you. There are people here that are bad, but the majority are good. We're people that are looking for a better future. Do you think, like everyone else, that we're all bad? We're terrorists and criminals? A lot of people think that, right?
Voices from the migrant caravan. Migrants have started arriving at the border. Thousands are expected over the coming days in Tijuana. Meanwhile, north of the border, some 6,000 American military troops have been waiting. We'll visit both sides in a moment. First, though, the Camp Fire in Northern California has killed more than 60 people. Authorities have announced that more than 600 others are missing. That's a huge jump from 130. That was the reported number on Wednesday. The campfire has become the most destructive in our history here in California. It has burned an area more than three times the size of Washington, D.C. NPR's Kirk Siegler joins us now from Chico. Hi there.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, the Butte County Sheriff announced yesterday that 631 people are missing. How did that number suddenly jump so high?
Well, you know, as you mentioned there in your lead, it's been sort of all over the map. One day it was missing, the reported missing numbers was over 200, then it was down to about 130, and then, you know, last night he told us, well, actually, the number of missing is now, we believe, jumped by more than 500, which I should say there was a big audible gasp in the room when he said that. He attributed that to, and this is true, there's a lot of confusion and chaos going on, and there are people still reporting in, or the numbers are fluctuating because someone maybe didn't know that they were on the missing persons list and didn't know they needed to report. So it's been jumping. But, you know, last night's news that there likely or could be more than 600 people still unaccounted for was very troubling and was met, you know, it was a kind of a big shock around here after a week of a whole lot of shock.
Right, right. And so I imagine people are desperately searching for those people, the 630 or so people, or perhaps more. Could that number go even higher?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think, you know, the community is growing more frustrated. At this point, people just want to know, you know, where their loved ones are. I don't think this is really a search and rescue effort much anymore. I don't mean to sound grim, but, you know, the teams have been going through all the rubble up there for days now, and people know and have heard or are sort of fearing the worst. And we, you know, keep expecting the number to go up in terms of the death toll each night. The sheriff will give a briefing around 6 o'clock, and kind of at the end of his talk, everybody's just sort of waiting and bracing and fearing the worst and expecting that death toll to keep climbing, and yeah, it likely will.
And most of the missing people are elderly?
At this point, yeah, we've been scanning the list here. A lot of people are older. There were a lot of retirees living up there, a lot of people on fixed income. Paradise was largely a bedroom community to Chico. Was a place where a lot of people could afford to live. I've met a number of people who moved out here from the Bay Area to retire. It's just cheaper. And a lot of those people just likely couldn't get out.
You've been talking with residents who did get out. What have they been telling you about how they're coping now?
Oh, it is just a, you know, stressful, stressful time, and it's hard to even put words to it. You know, I've been to a lot of these fires before and covered big fires before, but nothing to this scale. And, you know, everybody you meet, it seems like, will tell you, I lost my home, I lost this or I lost that. There's a good place to meet a cross-section of fire victims is downtown here in Chico at the post office, where, you know, many are lining up just to find their mail and get other services because they have nowhere else to go. I met Mike Wood. He lost his home. Just a tragic story. His wife has breast cancer. She's 5 months into chemo. And, you know, she was supposed to get more treatments this week at the hospital up in Paradise, and that burned down. So let's listen to Mike Wood for a second.
I think she's regressing right now. She's inhaling too much particulate matter, and it's making her cough, and the tension on her chest is just not what she needs right now.
You know, Madeline, that's the other big story around here right now, the smoke.
Mm-hmm.
It is unbearable. And there are serious health risks. And it's been like this for days where I'm standing talking to you at the fire camp. I mean, you can barely see a block in front of me. The sun is poking out, so I guess that's a good sign. But, you know, that's the other big concern around here, too, as if this community didn't have enough to worry about.
Absolutely. And then that smoke has traveled all the way down to Sacramento, to San Francisco. They've closed the schools there.
Yeah. And I, you know, as I mentioned, I've covered a lot of fires before. I was just so surprised by, you know, flying into Sacramento earlier this week and driving 80 miles. But even landing in Sacramento, the smoke was unbearable. Just the swath, the large scale of all of this smoke getting trapped in the Central Valley, the Sacramento Valley, and going all the way into San Francisco with, you know, particulate matters that you might see, readings that you might see or be more accustomed to seeing in China. The pollution and the smog is just really bad right now. Watery eyes, itching, coughing, you name it. And those are the, you know, at the very minimum.
So are people walking around with masks on?
Yep. I'm looking at a couple right now, in fact, and a guy brave enough to ride a bike over there is also wearing one. I mean, I guess, not to put it lightly, but they're a widely seen fashion accessory around here at this point and basically a fact of life.
Wow. Well, okay, so the fire's still not out. We have to remind people.
No. This is going to burn for some time. A fire like this, you know, these sorts of modern mega fires, firefighters can't put this out. They can at best try to contain it. They are making some progress. The wind has been, you know, considerably less strong in recent days. But they're, you know, optimistic that some rain in the forecast later next week, still like a week away, will help them contain it possibly by the end of the month. But then that rain brings another concern that folks, especially your listeners in Southern California, know too well, mudslides, particularly like last year. That may be the next story here. That's a big concern going forward.
All right. Well, Kirk, thank you so much. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
That's Kirk Siegler, NPR national correspondent, reporting on the campfire there in Northern California. Coming up, the beginning of the migrant caravan has arrived in Tijuana. We'll go there to check it out, and to the U.S. side, where some 6,000 troops have been preparing. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The first wave of migrants in that caravan coming up from Honduras has started arriving at the United States-Mexico border. It could be anywhere between 3,000 and 11,000 people eventually. Trump has labeled the caravan an invasion and placed almost 6,000 military troops at the border. We're going to talk more about what the troops are doing to prepare. First, though, let's go to Tijuana to see what's happening there with Rebecca Plevin, immigration reporter for the Desert Sun. Hi, Rebecca.
Hey, Madeline.
Well, how many migrants have arrived so far?
So we were at the migrant shelter this morning. It's a sports complex that the local government and state government have turned into a migrant shelter. And there are about 2,000 people right now. We've heard there's, you know, probably at least 2,000 more coming this weekend.
Okay, so is Tijuana set up to handle this influx?
That is the big question. The local government said there are about 900 spots available in Tijuana's migrant shelters and in local churches. Then the state government and the local government have opened up this migrant shelter. And it's this, you know, this sports complex, and they can sleep about 360 people on the floor of a basketball court, an indoor basketball court. And then they have lots of people outside in grassy areas and on, you know, a softball field, sleeping in these open, people have these large tents and then in individual camping tents. And it sort of seems like they are providing some services. They weren't necessarily ready with these services when the migrants first started arriving, but it seems like they are trying to provide some of these services now.
And I understand there's been a little bit of tension between the migrants and the locals.
Right. So we were at, as I mentioned, a lot of the migrants, they arrived and they went down to this neighborhood called Playa de Tijuana, and people were trying to camp there. And the residents of this neighborhood were just really upset that, that the migrants were camping in this public area instead of going to the shelters. And so there was this sort of this 3-hour-long, at least, confrontation that occurred Wednesday night, where the local residents came to the beach and they were said that they were there. They were demanding security in their neighborhoods and demanding the migrants, leave the beach area and go to the shelters. It did get pretty intense at times. People would say, they sort of call out, like, get out of here, leave here. And it got pretty intense. There were points where the group sort of started pushing and shoving and kicking, and it really heated up.
And you've been speaking with some of the migrants and learning some of their stories. What are they? What are they telling you about why they left Honduras?
A lot of people that I've spoken with over and over, you hear a lot of the same things. I think the biggest thing that people say is that there is just no work in Honduras. There is no work, and if there is work, it's not paid well, and they just do not have enough money to feed their families. I spoke at the shelter yesterday. I spoke with one migrant. His name is Edwin, and he explained, he sort of listed off all of the reasons that, that pushed him to leave Honduras.
Pobreza, hambre, delincuencia.
Poverty, hunger, crime, bad government. I couldn't find work. There's a lot of discrimination. When you get older than 30 years old, it's super hard to get a job. Lack of physical safety. There are a lot of problems with security. They'll kill you if you don't get along well with the gangs. I think that everyone is looking for a better life, work, get themselves or their families ahead in life.
So I guess that's a common story, right?
Absolutely. That's a story I hear over and over. It's a lack of jobs, lack of security.
What was it like going through Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, arriving at Tijuana?
Right. So a lot of these migrants, this group, they left Honduras more than a month ago at this point. And, they walked through Mexico, through most of Mexico. There are times where it was really hot. There was times where it was really cold, where there wasn't enough food. I'm sure you've seen some videos of people, jumping on trucks and riding on the back of these trucks. And Edwin talked about what the journey was like also.
Days of being very tired, dangerous days. But we're all here, and God has helped us. We were sick, famished, hungry, everything. Everyone in the caravan knows what it's like to suffer in order to get here.
All right, so what does Edwin plan to do now that he's made it to the border?
What I heard from him is what I hear from a lot of the migrants is that they're sort of going to wait and see. People have heard about the option of asylum. I think they've also heard that, that asylum seekers here in Tijuana often have to wait a month or longer for their chance or their turn to seek asylum. So we've heard about that process. I think more than anything, I think he and lots of the other migrants, like, their main goal is they really want to work. They're really looking for an opportunity to work. And so I think they're sort of trying to figure out, what is the best option for them to go somewhere where they can work.
Well, with thousands more arriving and with the conditions as you describe them, are people worried this is going to turn into a humanitarian crisis?
That is really one of the big questions here in Tijuana right now. Reporters have been asking local and state officials, is this a humanitarian crisis? And all the officials are saying, no, this is not a humanitarian crisis. A couple of years ago, there was a large wave of Haitian migrants that came to Tijuana, and the local officials said, we handled that situation. We, we sort of cared for those migrants, and we can do that here, too. The mayor this morning held a press conference, and he said that this is not a humanitarian crisis. He said if we weren't able to provide them water and shelter, it would be, but, in this case, we are, so this is not a humanitarian crisis. But I think that's the big question for a lot of people. Again, you have capacity for 3,000 migrants in that one shelter, but already, outside of the shelter, there are people sleeping on the sidewalks outside of the shelter. So I think there's a lot of concerns about the migrants being here. I think the community in Tijuana is conflicted over their presence, and I think, as more people come, we're going to have to see how everything plays out here in Tijuana.
Rebecca Plevin is an immigration reporter for the Desert Sun, reporting from Tijuana. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Well, on the other side of the border, about 6,000 U.S. military troops have been waiting for the caravan to arrive. President Trump ordered the troops to the border just before the election, though it's far fewer than the 15,000 he originally called for. The troops are expected to be there until mid-December, meaning they will be away from their families on Thanksgiving. The overall scope of their mission isn't exactly clear. KQED's John Sepulveda took a tour of the border this week and talked with some troops, and he's here now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, what did you see when you were down there?
I saw a lot of people being busy, kind of doing nothing, if I were to sum it up. And what I mean by this is that while President Trump has asked for walls, he instead is getting wire on top of already existing fence, this being razor wire. I see a lot of Marines kind of just basically putting razor wire on already made fences and sections that you could describe as you know, some of the most heavily guarded border in the world. So they weren't really doing a whole lot. It seemed that it was much more for the camera, so to speak, to have this presence there than to actually do any operational duties.
Although the migrants hadn't arrived by when you were there, now that they're there, are the troops expected to do anything else?
No, and this is really important. So the troops have been doing this. And right now, as you were saying in the beginning, there were expected to be a lot more, but they have since really scaled back the mission. There's about 150 Marine troops on the border at any given time. And they have non-law enforcement duties, which means they won't engage. If they were to see someone scale the fence, cut the razor wire, jump down, and run away, they would not engage with that person. And also, it's really important, you might remember that President Trump said, well, if people throw rocks, we should shoot them. We should treat them as though they have fired a gun at us. It's really, really clear that that's not going to happen. This is an Army captain who's overseeing the public relations aspect for it, Army Captain Guster Cunningham, and he said that they will not be engaging with these migrants in any capacity, especially if they're throwing rocks. Here he is.
So one of the things we heard the president say is if they throw rocks, we should treat that as a gunshot. That would not govern your actions.
Correct. We as armed service professionals will continue and remain sturdy professionals in our capacity to do what we've been asked to do.
And Madeline, you heard the trolley behind there, mm-hmm. That beep. We're seeing that there's been so far no slowdown in commerce. If it weren't for the Marines that were there on the U.S. side, you wouldn't know that there are about 5,000 migrants in Tijuana right now.
Okay, you heard him say we will remain sturdy professionals in our capacity to do what we've been asked to do. So what is it that they've been asked to do? I guess it seems like there's confusion on all sides.
All they've been asked to do really is put the razor wire up. I mean, that's what, and they've erected these barriers. So like, say that, I don't know, 1,000 or so of these migrants decided that they were going to try and charge the U.S. border. There are these concrete barriers, again, with just razor wire that they would be able to move by forklift pretty rapidly at the San Ysidro port of entry. And in the meantime, like you said, you know, these Marines, they're active duty, so it's not clear whether they would have been able to go home for Thanksgiving or not. But they would have been based in Camp Pendleton. There would have been, you know, kind of holidays for that. Right now, they're in Imperial Beach, which is a beach community in San Diego. They've kind of turned the town into a military tent city. There's a bunch of tents at the beach. That's where they're staying, these Marines. And they're really not doing much besides putting that razor wire up.
So they're living in tents on the beach right now. And yeah. Just biding their time.
Yeah.
Do we know how much this is costing?
We don't know. And that was something I asked. And part of that was because when the Pentagon first did projections of this, it was for a much more ramped up service. And that's not the case now. It's also going to be really interesting. Does this come, which budget this comes from? Because that's going to matter. But we did ask about the question. What I will say is it's not inexpensive. You have a lot of military specialists like Mr. Cunningham, who we heard from, the captain, the Army captain. He's stationed in Washington. You have other folks who are not stationed at Pendleton with the Marines who've had to come high command basically to oversee this. So this isn't an inexpensive proposition, but it is something that could fall within the regular budget depending on what they do, these troops, for the rest of the year.
Well, thanks, John.
Thank you.
John Sepulvedo, he co-hosts the California Report for KQED in San Francisco, which you can hear every weekday morning right here on KCRW. Coming up, we'll have your Friday film reviews and Tim Blake Nelson, who stars in the Coen Brothers film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
They wanted to set up a character who's grinning and friendly and benign, and then having the guy become ruthlessly, but still smilingly violent.
Movies next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Coen brothers have a habit of elevating character actors to leading men. They did it with Tim Blake Nelson in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where he played Delmar O'Donnell. And they're back at it with him again in their new movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. He plays Buster Scruggs.
Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me?
His story combines two big tropes of Westerns, the singing cowboy and the bloody, cruel Wild West. And Tim Blake Nelson joins me now. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
Well, it's a great pleasure to have you. And you are the first, you're in the first chapter of a multi-chapter, and they're really discrete stories in this movie. So The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, well, that is just one chapter of many. You kick it off, and we see you in the first scenes on a horse by yourself singing. Is that actually you singing?
It is. Yes, I'm singing. They learned that I could sing on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, kind of in fits and starts, but ultimately they determined that I could sing my own part in that movie. And so they wrote this part for me where I got to sing a lot.
And play the guitar.
Yes, which I didn't know how to do, so I learned to play the guitar for this movie.
Oh, so you play pretty well, considering you just learned. Was it hard to learn?
It was, because I was doing it at the age of 53, when the mind is a bit less supple. But I had a wonderful teacher in my 19-year-old son, Henry, who was patient and encouraging and kind, but he was also exacting. And then I practiced every day for about 5.5 months, along with doing pistol tricks every day for about 5.5 months.
Pistol tricks?
Yes, to prepare for this part.
What are pistol tricks?
Well, spinning the pistol and twirling it and reholstering it without having to look down at the holster. Buster Scruggs, the title character in the movie, whom I get to play, is an expert at spinning pistols. So he has that trope as well in terms of being a singing cowboy.
And he's a pretty accurate shot.
A very accurate shot.
So what did you want to get across? Because that can be a cliche, right? The accurate pistol, you know, performing cowboy who has a deadly shot. What did you want to explore with that?
Well, I can tell you what I wanted to explore as an actor, but it's the Coens who are doing the exploring. And I think what they wanted was to have a what's often the root of comedy, the juxtaposition of the incongruous. They wanted to set up a character who was a Gene Autry or Roy Rogers-like singing cowboy from a 40s singing cowboy movie, who's grinning and friendly and benign with all the ludicrousness that that entails if you look at those really fun movies from that era of the Western, and then turn the convention on its head by having the guy become ruthlessly but still smilingly violent.
And not only does he sing and twirl a mean pistol, but he also speaks in a very formal dialect or a formal way of speaking.
I'd like me a splash of whiskey to wash the trail dust off in my gullet and keep my singing voice in fettle.
That is funny because he's greeted with basically grunts and scowls.
Whiskey's illegal. This is a tri-county.
Well, what are they drinking?
Whiskey.
That's the beauty of Joel and Ethan. And I think what the actors who get to play their material enjoy and embrace is that polysyllabic rhetoric, which is often at odds with what you'd expect the character to be.
There's a great scene in the bar where you lead them in a chorus of song after you've laid waste to various bad guys, and everyone's really happy.
It was long about last April he stepped into this saloon, but he never really took to anyone. Surly Joe,
Surly Joe,
Surly Joe,
Surly Joe.
Oh, wherever he's gambling now, I don't know.
And it's, again, as often in Joel and Ethan's movies, there's an antecedent in film history. And that's quoting a dance number that Marlena Dietrich has in a movie called Destry Rides Again.
And you say that they wrote this for you. Why did they want to write this for you?
I'm not sure. I guess you'd have to ask them. In part, I think that they enjoy with some of their troupe learning about who we are and then throwing challenges at us. There's a funny example in John Turturro, who for several movies, Barton Fink and Miller's Crossing, he was very obsessed with his hair. He would start thinking about a character in terms of the hair. And so they wrote Oh Brother, Where Art Thou with the role Pete as John's role. And the first description you read in that script is that he's nearly bald. And so they wanted to give John a role in which he couldn't lean on the crutch of the hair just because they thought it would be funny. And Joel has told me that they wanted to throw a lot of challenges at me. And I think that's in part what was going on here. But I just, like anyone, and you think of the rest of the cast of this movie, grateful that they give us anything. And ultimately, the challenges that they furnish are of the sort that really get actors excited. And that's what's incredible about Joel and Ethan.
As I said, this is your part, is one of six stories in the film, and they're all discrete. They're all their own, like, short stories. Theme-wise, though, they all share, I think, this feature that life is short, brutish, and nasty, and you never know when the end will come, and it will come in the most absurd way possible in certain cases.
Yeah, it's important to remember that Ethan was a philosophy major. So the theme of mortality suffuses the film. And then in the final episode, there's a speech given by this character who is a reaper of sorts, self-identified reaper. And he asks the question, why do we like stories? What is storytelling? Why do human beings gravitate toward hearing narratives and engaging with narratives?
Because, well, they connect the stories to themselves, I suppose. And we all love hearing about ourselves, so long as the people in the stories are us, but not us.
He concludes that it's a distraction from our mortality.
Not us in the end, especially. The midnight caller gets him, never me. I live forever.
And ultimately, in a compendium of stories that each of which addresses mortality, to have that conclusion rendered in the final chapter is, I think, pretty profound.
And I guess I'm wondering now, in our, you know, with the news being so full of horrible crimes involving guns, mass shootings and the like, if that weighed on you in any way as you were playing this character.
No.
You're saying that it was done like it was humorous, and which it is. I just wonder if you worried about real life sort of encroaching on that and unintentionally.
Just to be honest with you, now that you mention it, I suppose I will add that to my worries. but it hadn't occurred to me. And because Joel and Ethan are conspicuously not topical filmmakers, and you can come up with examples that contradict that, but I think that they're not topical filmmakers. And I don't think topical is a bad word, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're much more philosophical. And so I think if that had crossed my mind, it probably would have been inhibitive in certain ways that wouldn't have been good for the movie.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Ethan was a philosophy major, and I read that you were a classics major at Brown.
That's right. Correct. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I wanted to ask you, do you guys talk philosophy, ancient philosophy, between takes at all? Or?
Yeah. It's as funny as it sounds. There's a lot of talk about literature and philosophy between us. But they're two of my closest friends. Mm-hmm. So that affords us a lot of time off the set as well. Joel and Ethan, they are resolutely intellectual people. And they're incredibly thoughtful. And they're extremely well-read. But they never want to wear that. So you've got to persist with them. And usually it's best done in private.
Do you find it comforting in this time of, I don't know, I mean, it seems like we're in a pretty dark time to have that background, to be able to lean on scholars of yore for answers?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think that answers to how to be, how to live what's called a eudaimon life, a healthy life, how to be as healthy and salutary a version of yourself as possible, the answers to that, I think, are found in the ancient thinkers, whether it's Plato or Lucretius, Epicurus. I think they give us the best advice for how to live a life.
Is that hard to do at all when you're working in Hollywood?
I don't find it difficult to do at all. I really don't. I have been married for almost 25 years. I have three really cool boys. I'm still in love with my wife. Have I turned down certain opportunities throughout my life so that that all remains true in terms of my reality? Yes. I've forgone certain pleasures in the moment to be able to have the life that I have, but it's been completely worth it.
I understand you're working on a play that you wrote about Socrates, which will premiere at the Public in New York this spring.
Yes. Yes, it's a 3-hour, hopefully that'll seem like 45 minutes, but it's a 3-hour evening about the life of Socrates in ancient Greece. And in some ways that are oblique and some that are very direct, how that thinker's life and approach to philosophy and politics and civic life applies to our time right now.
Wow, it sounds super relevant, even though, of course, it takes place in ancient Greece. But
I hope it's relevant. He was concerned with why we choose our leaders. What is a democracy? Should we have more of a republic or a pure plebiscite-driven democracy? What are the advantages of each? Should we be ruled by elites who specialize in the process of ruling, or should we be ruled by plebiscite votes, just up or down votes on every issue? And Socrates was also an early ethicist. What is a good life? What does it mean to do good? What does it mean to do evil? Do we rely on each? And all these unanswerable questions were being asked way back in ancient Greece.
Well, it's just been such a pleasure speaking with you. You've given me a lot to think about, so thank you for that.
My pleasure to be on your show very much.
Tim Blake Nelson, actor, director, and writer. He plays Buster Scruggs in the film The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. The film is out now in select theaters and, as of today, on Netflix. Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews, so don't go anywhere. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so that means it's time for movie reviews. Vincent Van Gogh and Dumbledore return to the screen this weekend. Christy Lemire and William Bibbiani are here to tell us what to see. Christy Lemire is co-host of the podcast What the Flick, and William Bibbiani is co-host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed. Welcome back, both.
Hello.
Hello.
Let's begin with Widows. This has a star-studded cast with Liam Neeson, Michelle Rodriguez, Daniel Kaluuya, Colin Farrell, and of course, starring Viola Davis.
My husband left me the plans for his next job. All I need is a crew to pull it off.
Why should we trust you anyway?
Because I'm the only one standing between you and a bullet in your head.
William, this is Steve McQueen's first film since 12 Years a Slave. How does it measure up?
Well, I mean, they're very different experiences. This one is a heist movie set in contemporary Chicago. And Steve McQueen is not the kind of person who's going to make a fun, blood and guts, grindhousey kind of action movie. He's very interested in how economic strife and political turmoil in Chicago is affecting people and forcing people to turn to acts like crime. And on that level, it's a very intelligent, slick, well-produced motion picture with a dynamite cast.
And the general plot is a bunch of women get together to pull off one last caper.
Right. So these are the widows of this group of men who were a criminal syndicate. And so when they all get killed, which is not a spoiler, the film is called Widows.
Right. It's the first scene.
It's the very beginning. They go off and they all need money now. And they need to survive and they need to get out of this life. And so they pull off the last heist that this gentleman had planned. But also, it's about a lot. It's about being a woman in America, a woman of color in America, a person of color in America. And he gets all these meaty, heady themes in there in a film that is like a big studio, glossy heist movie. So I was very impressed by the balance that's going on here.
And I thought the balance was just a little bit off. I thought it was a little bit more skewed in favor of all of those heavy themes, all of which are fascinating and richly explored. But I thought it ended up giving the film a somewhat dour presentation that took away from the heist elements, which I thought should have been more exciting and overpowering in order to compensate.
But it's radical to have a black woman leading a group of, you know, in a heist movie. That in and of itself, he's making a political statement.
I don't think I've seen that since Set It Off, which is also a brilliant movie people don't talk about enough. So yeah, that part's fantastic.
And that he's setting it in Chicago, he's also making another political statement, right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
So lots of political statements in here.
But
also,
but it's fun.
Okay. So you can have your vegetables and your dessert in the same meal.
Yes.
All right, let's move on to J.K. Rowling's Fantastic Beasts. It's a return engagement starring Johnny Depp, Eddie Redmayne, and Jude Law.
I have some questions for you, Professor.
This is a surprise.
There's a rumor that Newt's commander is headed to Paris. I know he's working under your orders. What do you have to say for yourself, Dumbledore?
Okay, Christy, explain this movie to us.
Okay, I wish I could. This movie is not really all that fantastic, and there aren't that many beasts. So there is some false advertising going on here. So this is part of the whole spin-off universe from the Harry Potter movies. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them was a movie that came out a couple of years ago. They're going to make like 5 of these. I have no idea how they're going to get 5 whole movies out of this idea.
These are prequels,
right? It's a prequel, yes. They are set in the 1920s, and Newt Scamander, played by Eddie Redmayne, is this magic zoologist. So he deals with magical creatures and critters and funny little weirdos. And like that part was fun in the first one. There's not quite so much of that here. There's a whole lot of other plot going on here. Johnny Depp, who is Grindelwald, he's a criminal. And at the beginning of the film, he is breaking out of prison during a transfer. Eddie Redmayne is then tasked by a hot, hunky young Dumbledore, played by Jude Law, to go track him down. Because Dumbledore can't do it himself, because Dumbledore has a whole past with Grindelwald, which they don't nearly go into enough.
I'm already confused.
Right. There are so many plots and characters and things going on here. Basically, it's about fascism.
It is. No, it's it's set in like the in Europe in the late 1920s, and it starts getting really directly about fascism and discrimination and prejudice. And whether it's successful is up for some debate. I know a lot of people who really don't like this movie. I actually thought it was really interesting, but I am coming at it from the perspective of someone who has read all the books, who, because I've read all the books, I know more about Dumbledore's relationship with Grindelwald.
Mm-hmm. What is the nature of their relationship?
Basically, without coming right out and saying it, they were lovers. Like that was the heavily implied subtext of the books. And then when you see, like, there's a little flashback bit in this movie where they are very intimate with each other, and they were just like, someone's like, yeah, you and he were like brothers, weren't you, Dumbledore? And Dumbledore's like, more than brothers. Mm. And but they don't want to come out and say it. And I think the issue of the representation continues in this movie, and that part is frustrating. But these movies are not based on novels the way the other Harry Potter movies are, but they play like it. And when you watch the Harry Potter movies, it's easy to get frustrated by all the things that they leave out, all the subplots that go kind of unexplored, all the characters who don't really seem important unless you've read the books. This movie plays very much the same way. There's like a 1,500-word novel or 1,500-page novel that of this that probably fills out all the blanks and is really dramatically thrilling. And here, it's like we're reverse engineering it. So I'm watching this scene. I know it's supposed to be important. I get the gist of it. But I have to kind of fill in some of the dramatic blanks myself. Now, I was excited to do that, and I liked it because I'm a fan. I was able to piece it all together, but I can see this being incredibly obtuse. They're keeping a lot of balls
in the
air.
So this is not something you necessarily would bring a kid to.
It's heavy and it's dark, but if kids are already into the whole Harry Potter universe, maybe. I mean, J.K. Rowling wrote this script. She wrote the script for the last one as well, and I get the sense that like there's nothing and no one reining her in.
Okay, let's move on to Green Book, starring Mahershala Ali and Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah.
Some guy called over here, a doctor. He's looking for a driver. You interested?
I am not a medical doctor. I'm a musician. I'm about to embark on a concert tour in the Deep South.
All right, William, what is the plot of this movie?
The plot of this movie is a classical musician named Doc Shirley, real person. He is going on a tour of the Deep South, and he is a black man, and so he needs someone there to protect him. And he enlists an Italian-American from New York called Tony Lip, played by Viggo Mortensen, to chauffeur him, but also, if necessary,
protect him.
And they develop a relationship over the course of the film. It's based on a true story. These are real people. And yet, of all the true stories they could have picked to make a movie about, they picked one that feels really contrived. I think Mahershala Ali and Viggo Mortensen are two of the best actors working today. I think they're really incredible in this movie, but the material they get is very superficial and really desperate to make you feel good about some of the worst things about the time period that it's in. And I think it ultimately does the history and the very topic of racism quite a disservice, even though on the surface it's a very well-made film.
Yeah, it takes place during 1962 in the Deep South. And so, yes, it is a period of violence and turmoil. These two have such tremendous chemistry. They are both such pros, and they play so beautifully off of each other that you kind of forget that it's pure formula. You know, it's every formula. It's a mismatch buddy road trip movie. It's an overcoming your racist prejudices movie.
It's Huck and Jim.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And you see a million times we have seen this, but it's so glossy. It's the kind of like feel-good big studio filmmaking we don't really see very often. And what is very surprising is that it comes from Peter Farrelly.
Of the brothers?
Of the brothers,
really?
Right. So this is a rare solo directing film for him. It does not make sense when you think about, you know, Dumb and Dumber and Something About Mary. But a lot of those films, despite the crassness and the bodily fluids and all that, it had an underlying sweetness and a message of tolerance and decency. So I guess it kind of makes some sense. But no, it's really fun. And I got to say, I brought my kid who is 9 and we had a really good talk in the car on the way home. So if nothing else, yeah, it's really basic and sincere and hokey. It might be a good way to have a conversation.
Okay. All right. Next up, a movie about Vincent van Gogh. It's called At Eternity's Gate, and it stars Willem Dafoe as Vincent van Gogh.
So that's the reason why you cut off your ear. Your vision of the world is quite frightening, isn't it?
Yes. Sometimes I feel so far away from everything. I think I'm losing my mind.
All right. How many movies out now about Vincent van Gogh?
So many. He loses his ear in all of them. Spoiler. The ear is going to go.
Yeah.
So this movie made me want to lose my mind because I found it so frustrating. Willem Dafoe is tremendous in this. And Julian Schnabel knows enough most of the time to just let him be on camera and let the fascinating cragginess of his face do a lot of the work and create a lot of the emotion. There's like a searching in his eyes and the colors are wondrous. I mean, it does feel like we are in the middle of Van Gogh paintings quite frequently. It takes place during his final years when he was in the south of France and did a lot of his most famous work. And the twilighty blues and the bright sunflowery yellows is all very evocative. But then Julian Schnabel, and again, he likes to play with perspective. He did this also with Diving Bell and The Butterfly. He messes around so much with like swoopy camera work and like zooming in on somebody. And there's a lot of first person perspective that is really distracting from just the core emotion, the core story he's trying to tell here. There's a thing he does, and I don't know if this bothered you too, Bibbs, but like it's almost like he's looking through bifocal sometimes.
He is.
And like half of the frame is in focus and half the frame is not.
Is that supposed to be from the perspective of Van Gogh?
Yes.
I think it is. I think this movie is trying to capture the creative spirit of Vincent Van Gogh. It has many of the bullet points that you might know from his life story, but it's more interested about what happens when he goes off into a field and just tries to capture something. And I think Julian Schnabel is trying to evoke that and trying to put you in the mindset of his genius. For me, I actually loved all that stuff. I thought that was maybe some of the most interesting storytelling. It maybe didn't always work, but I appreciated that it was daring. For me, the part of it that fell apart is there's one scene in this movie where this is all very intimate, all very told from Van Gogh's perspective, and then there's one scene where all of a sudden it's like he knows how he's going to be treated by history and he compares himself to Jesus Christ. I'm not appreciated now, but maybe I'm making paintings for people 100 years in the future and they'll make a movie about it. And I'm like, I don't think we needed that. And when he's comparing himself to Jesus, first off, that's hugely aggrandizing and it feels out of character. But also, it's Willem Dafoe. He is Jesus. He was the last temptation of Christ. So like you're watching this and it's hard not to giggle a little bit. It's like this one really off-key scene in an otherwise very intimate and engrossing motion picture that I loved.
I mean, it seems like what Julian Schnabel, who was a painter, maybe still is a painter before
sure
he started making
paints.
Movies or cracked plates or whatever, that he's actually trying to do making a movie what Van Gogh was trying to do, break some barriers, look at things with different perspectives. Is that generally the idea?
I think
maybe.
That's the idea. And I just think he ultimately calls his shot too hard. At some point, he was just like, this is what you're supposed to think. And I'm like,
and he's
okay,
not
Julian.
Van Gogh. He's not Van Gogh.
No, he's not. Who is?
Jesus.
Nicely done.
Nicely played.
William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon and critically acclaimed. Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of the podcast What the Flick. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, speaking of the second coming, here is Christian Bordahl for the fifth coming this week.
At least, yes. The migrants of the so-called caravan have started arriving at the border, and we talked about that earlier on the show. Many of them will no doubt be applying for asylum, and I asked listeners how they would like to see our government handle the situation. Joseph Lawrence says, is lawfully and respectfully an option? Stacey Sally says, give them the asylum they're asking for, to walk as far as they have under extreme conditions. They deserve to be heard and have an honest day in court. Unfortunately, if they even get to a courtroom, they'll have a 30-second hearing and be expelled. Salomon Pereira says, give them a chance to be heard. Alan Andalon says, agree with that. They should give it a chance to be heard, and then we can all see how bogus their claims are. They're economic migrants, pushed by NGOs and liberal foundations, funded by open borders globalists like George Soros. They will not get granted asylum, will instead stay in Mexico, and some will go back to Honduras. Salomon Pereira responds, the globalist and George Soros conspiracy theories don't fly with me. These are desperate people who are fleeing conflicts that, if you know your history, were created in part by the influence of the U.S. in those areas. And Kessler West says, make sure they have housing, with families staying together while processing their asylum requests. And a number of other people have weighed in on this one. It's an interesting conversation. If you'd like to get in on it, at KCRW Press Play on FB and Twitter.
Okay. Thank you so very much, Christian Bordahl.
Absolutely.
Appreciate that. That's it for our show. Our producers this week are Sarah Sweeney, Christian Bordahl, Amy Ta, Michelle Aloy, Yael Evan Orr, Alex Trigvedotter, and Adriana Cargill. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. Phil Richards engineered this week. I'm Madeline Brand. Barbara Bogave will be here on Monday, so have a great weekend.